One of the dilemmas of social media is the almost omnipresent nature of the spoiler, either by accident or sometimes design. Most spoilers involve serial shows, for example, you know, Netflix, the ones that drop an entire season in a single upload. And this, of course, leaves two kinds of people on the threshing floor. Those that have daytime commitments and those who have the ability to binge watch 13 episodes back to back of a single show with a Red Bull intravenous drip. The latter group always start carping online about their gripes, their plot traumas, and the deaths of particular characters. Anyone not savvy enough to avoid scrolling is bound to have their opaque knowledge base ruined by these freebasing lunatics. I remember this particularly with the Harry Potter book series inventory, in which it had to be guarded on pallets before the actual release, and in some cases by armed guards, because these malevolent gorgons were hip to driving around yelling out to the kids lined up outside that Dumbledore might have a personal problem with logistics. But then I realized the academics have been doing this forever, just not maliciously or on the knife's edge of accidental exposure. It's simply called the foreword to a book. And this is box number 7. So I have this rule in my life that is nearly intractable at this point. This rule has actually been in effect with me for a long time, but the genesis of this podcast has strengthened my resolve as I am reading a plethoric amount of books just to burp out what on the surface feels like some minimalist approach to some second-generation research. I'm no longer going to read the introduction to any book whatsoever. At the very least, I'm waiting until after the book is at least read by me before doing so, and I guess I should probably elaborate on that. When picking up a book, especially a classic, there is something to be said for the experiential side of it being unsullied, pure, as free from MSG, trans fats, and GMOs as possible. And if I'm getting ready to undergo an experience, which is exactly what reading is for me, would I want to appeal to the retrospective descriptions of some other person I don't know that had nothing to do with the writing of the book in the first place and listen to them say basically, "Hey, I've already read this, and here's what you should think about it before you read it yourself." So in reality, introductions by self-serving academics are really spoilers masquerading in the skirts of the analytical. And in what is perhaps the most ironic of examples, this involves a spoiler. Now, this involves a spoiler, and the spoiler is for a motion picture called The Sixth Sense. Now, listen, it's 25 years old. You've had a chance to see it. So if, for the most obscure of reasons, watching that film was next on your to-do list, then bail on the podcast now. Capiche? All right, good. Imagine back in 1999 when The Sixth Sense, starring Haley Joel Osment and Bruce Willis, came out in the theaters. Imagine that I set up a booth outside the veranda with a sign that said, "Cinematic analysis. Pass here before seeing film." As people came to me, I would hold up my Prince of Wales black tea and wax eloquent in a long, studied dissertation and would say the following. He's really outdone himself, both in terms metaphorical as well as cinematic. The protagonist, Dr. Malcolm Crowe, is initially presented as a man of disillusionment, both as a husband as well as a child psychologist. This becomes somewhat offset by a young client that appears to, quote-unquote, see dead people. Shyamalan's very clever shell game with the perceptions of the audience are unmatched in this regard, as we are taken along for a ride we will never forget. But let us not get too wrapped up in the eventual and revelatory discovery that both psychologist and client and others are actually dead themselves, and focus on Shyamalan's sudden and cathartic revelatory technique, one of retrograde visual analysis. We are treated to a sudden and comparative visual account of every moment in the film where we thought Dr. Crowe had interacted with those in his life, only to discover he was part of an unheard world in the afterlife. We were led to believe that his wife's contemplative moments of silence were her mourning a failed marriage, when in reality, he was watching her mourn his demise. In reality, this is about relationships and their value, not just the hallmarks of an existential thriller. Yep, and that would be it. I just ruined one of the greatest cinematic grassy knoll shots ever delivered by a director, all in the name of erudition and illumination. I feel less guilty about using a movie for my spoiler than a book, because I value literature far more over cinema. Oh, and by the way, if you're going to watch Titanic, the ship sinks, 3,000 people start chugging icy brine water, and Leonardo DiCaprio gets to utter pathetic romantic metaphors before sliding off a door into water that is 30 degrees Fahrenheit. By the way, author Joe Queenan tried to replicate this feat in real life, and it can't be done with DiCaprio's forlorn panache. Anyway, back to books. The lone exceptions might be where the author will write one themselves, or update one that they feel is antiquated. For instance, Eli Wiesel did this in his book Night, which chronicled his time in the Auschwitz death camp. But even then, I get a little suspicious. But aside from him, George Lucas has proven to me that even the originator cannot be trusted to handle their own material deftly, especially if the temptation to quote-unquote fix what isn't broken is part of their composite. Tousle-headed George has fooled around with his Star Wars canon so much that, quite frankly, I'm not even sure I like George anymore. I don't need some screening academic to warn me that the N-word might show up in Huckleberry Finn. I furthermore don't need to be headed off at the rhetorical turnpike over it. I can handle it. It was academics that banned the book in the first place. It was perfectly smart people that couldn't understand that Huckleberry Finn is one of the greatest literary indictments against racism. And instead, it metastasized into some cabal of overeducated nitwits that thought you and I might read the book and start lynching our black friends. The point is, I'd rather struggle with the concepts presented and work them out myself and not have them handed to me by someone who's quote-unquote already been there. You know, C.S. Lewis once said that the primary purpose of education was not to cut down trees, but to irrigate deserts. The obsession with weighing in on everything in advance anymore is, in my opinion, only accomplishes the latter of those two. And that's it for this mini episode of Box Number 7.